You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Our next presentation is The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. For those of you that have been living in the dark and don't know, this podcast is a bright beacon. And I think the reason for its popularity is... Well, because of the contributions of the people that are coming out here in just a moment. Evan Bernstein, Rebecca Watson, and the fabulous Novella Boys. Steve, Bob, Jay, Manny, Moe, and Jack. So, ladies and gentlemen, I give you The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Well, we are live from Nexus 2011. And as is usual at the live Nexus events, we have a special guest rogue to join us on stage. We've had many illustrious names in the past. This year we have a man who is a science writer, a former editor of Scientific American magazine, a current blogger, and an excellent guy. Let me introduce to you Mr. John Rennie.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being so easily impressed. I appreciate that.
Now, this is a very special episode for a couple of reasons. The New York live show that we do every year is always our memorial Perry DeAngelis lecture or show. So we always take a moment to remember the rogue who didn't make it here with us, but his... inspiration and in memory is always present on this stage with us. So in memory of Perry DeAngelis. And this is our 300th episode. Hard to believe we've been doing it for that long, 300.
It's a nice round number.
It is. It's a completely arbitrary milestone that we like to recognize. All right, well, Rebecca.
Yes.
I'm looking at here a picture of some cave art,
mm-hmm.
and the stick figures in that picture appear to be holding hands.
Yeah, you see...
Can you explain that to me, please?
I'd like to... I'd love to, Steve. You see, holding hands is gay. No, that's a fact. That's a scientific fact, substantiated by Time magazine, which chose to use this picture in relation to their article about... The gay caveman. That's right. Archaeologists recently discovered a gay caveman, or...
You sure they weren't paleontologists?
Uh-huh. Yes, Steve, I'm sure.
What's your epsilon on that?
3, 4? I sort of tuned out during that.
It was very dark in the caves.
I'm kidding, Phil. The gay caveman, or as I like to call him, the gave man. No? All right. I was hoping it would catch on. When I read the article, it seemed very interesting. They reported it as being a 5,000-year-old skeleton. And it was discovered near Prague. It was part of the courted ware culture. And this culture is really picky about the way they bury their dead. They bury women with their heads pointed east and men with their heads pointed west. So these archaeologists found a man with his head pointed east. And also, instead of being surrounded by manly heterosexual items like weaponry, he was surrounded
by Don't forget the tools.
Right. Man tools. Not
man tools.
Girl tools, yeah. Like pots and kitchen equipment. Which this is true. They would surround women with that sort of thing. And so this skeleton was surrounded with those sorts of things, and hence it was dubbed the Gave Man. Well, it was dubbed the gay caveman, but...
Do you think when he was alive he had a man cave?
That's the best you could do?
Yeah.
All right, keep working on it. The thing is, that's what the article reported, but there are a couple of problems with the story. For starters, this culture also tended to bury shamans and other magical-type people in different positions than they would normally position men and women. Also... The skeleton might not, in fact, be a man. Other archaeologists have pointed out that it can be really difficult to figure out whether it's a man or a woman just based on the bones, and there was no DNA evidence presented yet. I thought it was easier. I see it on that show Bones all the time.
Well, it's easy, 99% of the time, but there are certainly lots of medical disorders that lead to ambiguous gender. So, that's what you're saying is that they're leaping to this conclusion that, oh, it must have been a homosexual person at this time. But you can imagine lots of hypotheses that would explain this. You mentioned maybe he was a person of some significance. Maybe the people who buried him didn't like him and thought this would be a funny joke to play on the guy. I mean, who knows? Yeah. There's so many questions.
They're like, man, in 5,000 years, this is going to kill.
Yeah.
Frank is going to be the gay man.
I mean, that's as likely as anything else. So, you just cannot leap to this conclusion.
Yeah, and you mentioned a good point about the idea that there are certain diseases or certain issues that could cause the bones to look female. That brings up what to me is a larger point, which is that a lot of these cultures had a third gender. They didn't really subscribe to the same binary male-female idea of gender that we tend to. And so this gay man could have been on the spectrum of what falls within the third gender. So it could be transgendered or something else like that. And also there's the fact that he wasn't actually a caveman,
yeah.
Which kind of ruins the fun for everyone. But
then you can't say gay man.
Right. I mean, technically they were like a pre-Bronze Age culture. But it's okay. I've taken those things and I've come up with a new term. So I'm going with LGBT-olithic. So yeah, it's not as if they just found some man encased in amber singing along to Mariah Carey songs or something. It's not quite that.
I'm a little more scared about the fact that that's one of the robots from Doctor Who.
What, like
you mean a Dalek?
Yeah, look at the thing.
That is not what a Dalek looks like, Jay. Just
it's a crude drawing. I mean,
it could be a Dalek.
There's no plunger.
Let's move on. Bob, so there's more problems with cosmology that you got to straighten us out on.
I love it when scientists think big. I'm not talking about Large Hadron Collider big. I'm not talking about space elevator big. So I'm talking really big. I'm not talking about a space elevator. I'm not even talking about terraforming Venus. I'm talking about speculating about moving galaxies, taking stars and galaxies and putting them all together, and treating it just like it was some sort of extreme engineering job. And this is what Freeman Dyson, is a famous physicist, Freeman Dyson was talking about in an email exchange to a colleague about a time in the future when potentially intelligences, some super advanced civilization, might actually consider pulling this kind of stuff off. Now, to give this a little bit of context, you got to think about in the late 1990s, I'm sure a lot of people are aware of the big discovery, and I think it was in 98, that the universe is not only expanding, it's expanding at an ever-increasing rate, faster and faster and faster. It's not slowing down, it's not going to stop, it's just getting faster and faster. So if you extrapolate that into about 100 billion years, things get a little crazy. Anything in the galaxy, anything in the universe that you can imagine, any galaxy, any black hole that is not gravitationally bound, say, to the Milky Way and Andromeda and our local group of galaxies, everything out there is going to eventually just drop off from our view. We'll never see it ever again. It'll eventually just go beyond the event horizon of the observable universe. So if you were on, say, a planet in, not the Milky Way, because the Milky Way and Andromeda are going to merge into some combined galaxy. All these galaxies in our local group are going to do that.
Andromeda Way.
Yeah, a lot of astronomers are calling it Milkameda or something. I really don't like that. I like Andromeda Way a lot better. So if you're actually on a planet in Andromeda Way and you look up at the night sky, in 100 billion years, you're going to see pitch black. You're going to see nothing. No visible stars that within Andromeda Way because they're all pretty much red dwarfs. So unless you're a robot with eyes sensitive to the infrared, you're not going to see anything.
Which in a million years you probably will be.
Yeah. Even if these robots have telescopes, they won't be able to see galaxies or anything. So the big problem scientifically with cosmology anyway is that, I mean, is cosmology dead? How are you going to potentially infer that the universe is expanding if there's no galaxies to look at the supernovae to determine that, hey, things are going a lot faster the farther out? So also, what about the Big Bang? You can't even infer that the Big Bang happened because the cosmic microwave background radiation will have ballooned from 2 millimeters wavelength today to about a wavelength. How big do you think the wavelength is going to be in 100 billion years?
Really big?
Bigger than the observable universe. So it's going to be so big it's completely undetectable.
That's big.
So that's kind of how it stood. I remember being Steve. Remember I was kind of bummed. Like, yeah. Wow, that's kind of a bummer in 100 billion years.
Well, it's good that we live now, not 100 billion
years.
Right.
It's good that we live now, because in the future it's going to be very boring. But then last year, an astrophysicist, Abraham Loeb, he's from the Center of Astrophysics at Harvard University. He realized that maybe this won't be a problem, because you could infer the cosmic expansion and the Big Bang in other ways, like by looking at hypervelocity stars that are ejected from galaxies. Every 100,000 years or so, we get a star that gets close to the black hole, the supermassive black hole at the core. It gets ejected from our galaxy. And if you look at these series of stars that are ejected occasionally, you can look at the Doppler shift and you can infer that, hey, the universe is expanding, and it's even expanding faster and faster. So these scientists in the future can figure this stuff out. Now with the Big Bang, you could look at helium. There's no cosmic microwave radiation, so you can look at helium, though, and realize that, wait a second, there's so much helium in the universe, because stars can only cook up about 2% of the helium that we detect, but the universe has 25% helium. So where did this come from? It had to come from the entire universe at one point, being in a closed state, hot and dense, Big Bang. So they can kind of figure that out, too. So the future isn't quite as bleak at 100 billion years as you might think. If you go to a trillion years, all bets are off and things get really crazy, and that's another talk.
So we're worrying about other civilizations being able to detect the Big Bang a billion years from now.
It's fun to think about.
100 billion years from now.
100 billion years.
100 billion years. Yes.
It's an interesting logic puzzle. How theoretically could you infer cosmology
Right. Once
you're at the island, universe thing where everything is dropped off the horizon? But
things get really wacky, though, Steve, with Freeman Dyson, because he wasn't happy that you could still infer this stuff. He was like, but still, when you look at the night sky, you're going to see nothing. I mean, how romantic is that? So he's talking about intelligence, super advanced civilizations actually harvesting the gravitational energy of all these galaxies and bringing them together into one giant supercluster. And I love how he did the math on this stuff. He figured out that if you took 10% of the mass of 1% of the observable universe, you could take all that mass and have it gravitationally bound together. Now, you would need to modify it. You would need to artificially modify it so that it would stay together, because it would tend to want to go apart. But that it could be done. And it could be done in a Hubble age, which is the age of the universe. So it could be done in, say, 14 billion years. This could be carried out. I mean, it's one hell of an engineering project. But theoretically, it's possible. I don't know how we came to these numbers, because what kind of technology are we talking about? I'm not sure how harvesting gravitational energy is going to do this stuff. So,
yeah, but what does he mean by that? That's kind of like, and then a miracle happens.
Yeah.
Right? What does that mean, harvest the gravitational energy?
Right. Okay. I mean, wouldn't you have to gravitationally influence you? I mean, you have to create like a mobile mega object that could gravitationally pull. I mean, I don't know. But we're talking 100 billion years. Our robot overlords will figure it out. Okay, that's what's going to happen. But there's another interesting side to this, that you could use this cosmic engineering idea to figure out, well, maybe we can use this information to detect aliens. Because if you look into the universe, you could detect this cosmic engineering. Maybe it's happening right now. You could look for two things. There's two things that would be key indicators of this kind of stuff happening. One is our friend, the cosmic microwave background radiation. If it's incredibly redshifted, because this giant supercluster that's artificial would be so redshifted, the microwave radiation, that it would be anomalous. You would say, wait, this isn't right. Something's wrong here. Another thing you would look at are the peculiar velocities of the objects in this supercluster, because they'd be going really fast in order to be so close together. So that would be anomalous as well. So if you can detect these two things, you could say, whoa, this isn't right. Maybe there's some alien civilization working on this. And they've actually looked for this stuff. The data's already there. They've looked at it, and they didn't find it. So nobody apparently...
Shocked.
Yeah.
Shocked.
All right. Nobody apparently is working on this now, but we've got about 100 billion years to work on it. I think we should start raising money and start working on this stuff.
On a somewhat more modest temporal scale, actually, there's been some other recent work suggesting that if we were just looking for not those kind of ultra technologically civilized civilizations that Dyson is talking about, but your mere simple civilizations, super civilizations of the future, where they just move planets around, there have been suggestions that in fact one of the things that we should start looking for is the evidence of kind of asteroid reengineering. There would be a certain level of, if you are some kind of super civilization and you want a nice tidy solar system because you've got asteroids that you want to mine.
It's messy. It's a big mess.
There should be certain kind of telltale signs of, in effect, the tailings of that that will show up as signatures around certain stars. So that's something some people are going to start looking for evidence of extraterrestrial.
Interesting.
Yeah. So Bob, it's like you're saying, like, what would you call that? Like, what would you call moving a planet or pulling galaxies or solar systems.
Cosmic engineering. I mean, that's a good enough term. That's pretty descriptive. But and the interesting thing, though, this was an interesting aside. Some of the complaints people had was, well, okay, that's interesting. That would take a lot of work. Why not just travel to, like, say, the Coma supercluster, which is 320 million light years away? Just go to a supercluster and then make that supercluster kind of a little bit denser. Why create your own supercluster?
Yeah, what are they thinking?
Yeah, what were they thinking? And also, don't forget that the Andromeda Way is going to have 100 billion stars, red dwarfs, 100 billion planets potentially. There's lots to explore in our local, in our galaxy in that future. So it wouldn't be totally boring, although the night sky would still be pretty pathetic.
But so is Dyson just looking for more stuff to find because he never found a Dyson sphere? Which is, the surrounding a star with
a shell to absorb all the energy from the star.
Yeah, basically a civilization that lives off 100% of the energy being put out by a single star.
Nice.
Never found.
Isn't all the stars that you can see with the naked eye in our galaxy, though?
Yeah,
pretty much.
They're only in a few very local neighborhood.
It's only a few thousand. Yeah. But you might see some smudges of something a little further away. But it's primarily, yes, to all the stars that are very close to us.
So to the naked eye, nothing is going to change.
Oh, but all the stars will be red dwarfs.
No, well, since they're red dwarfs, they'll be invisible unless you're sensitive to infrared.
Okay.
Robot, remember that?
Yep.
Can I just point out before we move on that there's a sign language interpreter down here, and she's doing an amazing job because I have a hard enough time just following Bob, but to translate it. So, I assume she's I assume that they're both also physicists. So thank you.
I was hoping she wasn't just signing blah, 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 blah.
So, Jay, who are these two guys in this picture?
That's Dr. Oz and Dana Ullman. And if everybody does not know who either of them are, quickly, Dr. Oz is a shill for Oprah, who got his career on Oprah's TV show, not as a doctor, but as a person in the media that basically regurgitates BS. And Dana Ullman is a very interesting homeopath. He has his own website. He has more than one website. He writes a ton of books. He has quite a large following. And he's also completely and utterly full of it. The guy definitely...
But Jay, he writes for the Huffington Post.
Yeah.
What are you saying?
Well, I have to say that the stuff that he writes isn't just bad, but he's not a good writer either. And I took a deep dive on his recent article that he did put on the Huffington Post. And Steve blogged about this, but we went in two different directions. I just wanted to go in and do an analysis of what he wrote about and why it's wrong and on multiple levels. Like, actually, Steve and I edited down my list so it wasn't an hour talk just on this one article that he wrote.
Thanks, Steve.
So what Dana Ullman did was he picked a historical homeopath, and supposedly this was the first homeopath that actually treated people with radiation for cancer. But I'd like to start with just by saying that I went to his website to read more about Dana Ullman, and his website said, "Why our site is trustworthy and worthy of your business and support. Our owner is Dana Ullman, MPH, who Time Magazine described as the leading proselytizer of homeopathy, and ABC News touted as homeopath's foremost spokesman." Which, all that basically says is the guy talks for homeopathy, but they didn't accredit him with anything other than the guy just talks a lot about homeopathy.
He's an apologist for homeopathy.
So his regular article he has is in the Huffington Post. I think that's probably his largest outlet. And to get into what he started writing about, so he decided to write about a person named Emil Grubb, who was a homeopath in the late 1800s to up till 1960 when he died. He was, like I said, the first person to try to treat cancer with homeopathic radiation.
With radiation.
Yeah.
So the backstory here is Ullman is trying to argue that therapeutic use of radiation derived out of homeopathy, that it was really homeopathy that led to the insight that led to treatment both using radiation therapeutically and also the treatment of radiation sickness or radiation exposure or poisoning. And the logic and contortions he has to go through in order to make these connections is pure Ullman. I mean, it's astounding, but it reveals his shoddy scholarship, which we actually are very, very familiar with from many of his previous articles on the Huffington Post. But
So just follow me here. I have to read a little bit just so you get the idea of how he's writing and how he's relating the information. So he says, because one of the basic premises of homeopathic medicine is that small doses of a treatment can help those heal symptoms that large doses are known to cause, a fellow scientist suggested to Grubb that radiation may be a treatment for conditions such as tumors because it also causes them, which is, as you know, cures in homeopathy. And he continues, this incident is but one more example from history in which an insight from a homeopathic perspective has provided an important breakthrough in medical treatment. What? What's the insight? The insight that he's saying is basically the tenet of homeopathy is like cures like. So there was no insight here. It's just, oh yeah, well, cancer can be caused by radiation, so let's use radiation to cure cancer. I don't see any profound insight here.
Essentially, his reasoning in that case about that, well, certain doses of radiation will cause cancer, so maybe another smaller dose will fix it. It's kind of like saying that if you're in a car accident and you just get off into a certain number of other fender benders, maybe you can actually correct it.
But the reasoning there is atrocious because, again, this gets to this deeper question of what actually is homeopathy. And Ullman stretches the definition to the point where any time there you can use different doses of stuff to achieve different ends, he tries to say that's homeopathy, right? Because in high doses it's toxic, in lower doses you can use it therapeutically. That's every drug.
Yeah, they've done the same for...
It's even water.
They've done the same for vaccinations.
Yeah. The false analogy to vaccinations. Now he's making a false analogy to radiotherapy because there's nothing in the radiation that's having a different effect. The radiation in high doses kills cells and mutates them, and that's exactly what we're doing to the cancer. We're using radiation to kill the cancer cells in the same way that radioactivity causes harm, causes radioactive poisoning, and in fact, in those doses, it also increases your risk of mutations and causing cancer. But we're just trying to dose the tumor higher than the healthy tissue around it, and we accept a certain amount of damage to surrounding tissue because, you know, if you have a tumor that's going to kill you, it's worth the side effects of radiation. How is there a homeopathic principle in that in any way? It's not infinitesimal. It's not a different effect at different doses. It's just exploiting different dosages to achieve an end while minimizing side effects. Again, that's a pharmacological concept. It's not a homeopathic concept. But he's twisting this just to try to create this notion that homeopathy is legitimate because a couple hundred years ago, there were doctors who were also homeopaths. You know, a couple hundred years ago, doing nothing was actually an advantage over what passed for standard of care medicine. And a lot of people were dabbling in lots of ideas that were around at the time. So somehow that's supposed to lend legitimacy to homeopathy. And the fact that different doses do different things, it's all, you know, his tortured apologist logic.
So continuing on, this is one of my favorite quotes out of here. He says, even though Grubb had to have one hand amputated early in life due to the high exposure he received from using radiation, he ultimately lived a long and full life of 85 years, in part due to homeopathic treatment he received throughout his life. His homeopathic treatments cost him his hand.
Yeah.
So in that same sentence, he contradicts himself, and you know, you guys can clearly see, like, he's not following his own line of reasoning in that one sentence.
Yeah, I mean, he was getting radiation exposure to his hand to the point where his hand died and had to be amputated.
And that must have been
Success.
The hand that he,
yes.
You know, that he was actually...
Right.
It goes to show that weight loss can help you live longer and be...
And then for some reason, he decides to throw in there, Grubb also had a long and distinguished career as a professor of electrotherapeutics and radiography. Which, to me, just makes him sound even creepier. Like, imagine going to the guy's office, and he's like, you know, he can either shock you or irradiate you. And I know, we can go back and say, sure, but back then they didn't know, whatever. It's still, like, horrible to think about what he was doing to those people. And then Ullman does something wonderful here. He says, the point of this introduction is to confirm that homeopaths have a long history of using homeopathic medicines.
That's true.
Okay. In the treatment of people who have been exposed to radiation. So what Steve said before was, this was all him just validating the idea, okay, so now we've confirmed that homeopaths basically are riddled throughout the history of radiation poisoning and cures and understanding and research. You know, he thinks that what he wrote there, and I summed it up, you know, tightly for you, but that's pretty much all the real information that was worthy of reading in the article. He thinks that's enough to conclude that there's a relationship there. Which
it's legitimacy by association. That's what he's trying to do. And he strains it even further. Read the next part.
All right, so now that was his first person of historic value. Now he brings up another person of historical value, a man named Paul Curie, and do you recognize the name? This person was a French surgeon in 1832. Paul Curie friended Samuel Hahnemann. Anybody know who that person is?
Father.
Hahnemann.
Yeah.
Hahnemann, whatever. Founder of homeopathy. So now he quotes, homeopathy and homeopaths are also deeply connected to the origins of x-rays and radiation treatment in other ways, too. As it turns out, Paul Curie's son, now follow this. Paul Curie's son, the guy, had a son, Eugene. Eugene was a physician. He's intelligent. And Eugene had a son named Pierre. Pierre married who?
Marie.
Thank you. That's his connection to x-ray. This, and I'm going to say it, and some people are going to get upset, but this moron is the grandfather of the guy that married the brilliant scientist. Well, and this guy was actually pretty brilliant himself.
Yeah, I was going to say, Pierre was
part
pretty
of
brilliant
it.
Too.
You have a connection.
Right, it is. It's getting more deadly. So, that was just a point where Steve and I were, at this point, as we were talking about this article, we were laughing and thinking, okay, great. So you've made two unbelievably shoddy connections to some people that may have done some legitimate research, but these actually weren't the homeopaths. All right, so now we're shifting to something else. He just does a quick 1-2 and shifts to another topic. With the media promoted concerns about radiation drift from Japan and the real and exaggerated fears that many people are experiencing now, the first homeopathic medicine that people today may consider taking is Arsenicum Album 30C. Arsenicum Album is a leading homeopathic medicine for anxiety and fear, especially around health issues and about being poisoned. So I did not know what Arsenicum Album was, but it sounded like something we've all heard before, right?
Yeah, wait. Yeah. So, hold on, let me just get this straight. So you go to the doctor, and you're like, doctor, I'm having anxiety, I need some help. And he's like, what are you anxious about? And, like, that decides the solution? Like, I'm anxious about bears.
Yeah.
Like,
no, but it's worse. I mean, the guy, doctor, I'm really anxious that I have some poisoning.
Right.
Let me treat that anxiety for you.
Right.
Forget about the poisoning.
Right. You're going to feel a lot better while you die. Yeah.
So from the Wikipedia, Arsenicum Album. Arsenicum Album is a frequently used homeopathic substance derived from the metallic element arsenic. It is used by homeopaths to treat a range of symptoms that include digestive disorders, especially food poisoning, insomnia, allergies, anxiety, depression, and obsessive compulsive disorders, and it has been studied as a possible treatment for arsenic poisoning. Arsenic oxide is a homeopathic preparation, is highly diluted, and so is considered generally safe, although rare reports of arsenic poisoning from poorly prepared homeopathic treatments sold in India have been reported.
In fact, there's been arsenic toxicity from homeopathic remedies that are not derived from Arsenicum Album. They're just contamination.
Yeah.
But it actually doesn't matter that it's arsenicum because it's 30C, which means it's nothing. It's blah 30C is nothing. Whatever the blah is, it doesn't really matter. But I like the range. I always love the range of things that the treatment can allegedly address. Yeah. Like, they all have some kind of related or common cause. Yeah, GI disorders and anxiety and what
bears.
Else is in there? Yeah, and arsenic poisoning. Yeah.
Well, I can see GI disorders being caused by anxiety. You know, you get an upset stomach and all that. So then I'm sitting there thinking about this.
Yeah, but you're obsessive compulsive.
That's true.
Yeah.
I'm half of those things on this list. I then was thinking, well, according to the laws of homeopathy, because he did mention the radiation coming from Japan, according to the laws of homeopathy, this is me, as the radiation becomes more dilute on its journey to the west coast of the United States, it'll be getting more potent. So by the time it hits our coast, the homeopathic radiation should be deadly. But we didn't find that.
Or it'll cure us of everything, one or the other.
That was
an Ann
Coulter's point, I think.
Yeah.
Should be almost grateful to the Japanese in a sense, because the tiny little dose of hormetic influence of this radiation would actually boost people's immune systems. Go, Fukushima.
Yeah, or something. Yeah, right.
So I have two more things I want to quickly. And then quickly say, and I'll stop. So I'm quoting him again. Back in 1994, a highly respected group of researchers reviewed 105 animal studies that evaluated the ability of homeopathic medicines to discharge heavy metals from the bodies of mice. This review found that the best results were in the studies that were deemed to be scientifically rigorous. When evaluating only these higher quality studies, the researchers found a significant reduction in death rate to the animals. as compared with those given a placebo. What he should have wrote here was, when we cherry-picked the data, we found some bullshit results that fit right into our preconceptions. I'm going to pick the studies that were the best, or the ones that were the most rigorous, meaning the ones that had the results that we wanted. I mean, he basically says it right there. Yeah. And
well, I mean, it's okay just to put this into perspective. If you're doing a review or a meta-analysis or whatever, you do have to have some inclusion criteria, but you have to decide what those criteria are before you look at the outcomes of the studies. What this was doing was clearly cherry-picking, because I actually looked at this data and also just did a search for anything published on the use of homeopathy for toxicity and also for radiation poisoning. First of all, there's no data in people, so there's actually no data at all to support any clinical claims. There's the usual noise range of crappy animal studies, so there's lots of noise to cherry pick from, and that's what Ullman does. That's exactly what he does. He cherry picks data in order to support homeopathy. He's also notorious for citing articles to support his points when the articles actually contradict his points. Which I've documented in numerous, articles previously. So that's what he's doing here. But it's all just the end result of all of this is, a desperate attempt to portray homeopathy as legitimate because it's got some, tenuous historical connections. It's been studied. Then that's basically all he has to say. He doesn't have articles which show with high probability that it actually works. That's what he doesn't have.
And then the one thing I wanted to ask Steve was, what do you think about giving placebos to animals?
Well, yeah, why not? What's your point?
The point is, the process of administering placebo and everything, part of it is we're thinking about where you give people placebo for a number of reasons, I know, but you can't give placebo to animals. I mean, I know it's the placebo is the neutral, right, the baseline.
There is a common misconception that animals can't have a placebo effect, if that's what you're getting at. But that's not true, because the placebo effect is in the person who's evaluating the outcome of the animal.
How do you know that
the animal's doing better? Yeah, it's also the attention paid to the animal. There's lots of non-specific effects just being in a clinical trial. Actually, a vast minority of placebo effects come from the expectation of benefit. Although that's the thing that most people think makes up the entire placebo effect. So there's a huge misconception there. So yeah, there are placebo effects in animal, and you still need to do placebo-controlled trials. The question is, how well blinded were they? Were the outcomes, the people who were assessing the outcomes blinded? Because if they weren't properly blinded, yeah, you're going to validate your hypothesis. And that's what we see in the homeopathic literature all the time. Improperly blinded techniques leading to, surprise, surprise, positive results. But when you get down to the studies where we know the techniques were done properly because they were observed or replicated or whatever, the effects vanish. It goes away. It's like ESP.
So homeopathic researchers are blinding animals before they do
the studies? Blinded the evaluators.
No.
Gotcha. Gotcha. All right. There's another little quick homeopathy item. This caught Evan's eye, and this is also an advertisement for a homeopathic treatment. And we wanted to see what they had to offer. Why don't you set this up, Evan, and I'll pull up the
thing. Initially, because I heard it on the radio. And maybe you've heard it also. Zydestra, homeopathic remedy, will cure your vertigo, help treat your vertigo, restore your balance. I don't know if anybody else here has heard it. It's in the New York markets, Connecticut markets, the radio stations that I listen to. I've heard it in multiple places. Okay, so I went and I started to look at this. All right, found a YouTube ad on it, which pretty much was parroting exactly what the radio ad said, and then I went to their website, which is very interesting in itself. They ask you to take a self-test, all right, and asks you to put in check off your symptom, all right, the main symptom or symptoms that you're having, and when the onset of these symptoms occur, like driving in the car, looking out the window, or walking down halls or whatever. You click those in. And then you hit submit, and it gives you your result, all right? Yes, you have an imbalance problem. It's most likely vertigo and so forth. I put in about 12 different combinations of those variables, and it's all the same. All these in the same place. Kind of really a pointless exercise when it comes down to it. Now, they give you a telephone number to call in case you have any questions. I gave them a phone call, and we decided to share with you some of the highlights. We're good?
good?
Yeah, but what can Zyvestra do specifically?
All right, what Zyvestra does, what makes it so effective, it's the first of its kind to work in a homeopathic way to combine natural medicines in a dual-action treatment. It consists of cream you rub behind your ear and small tablets without the side effects, you know, you get from prescriptions. And what it does is it attacks the symptoms from the inside as well as outside behind your ear. Uh-huh. The reason you put the cream behind your ear, that's the area where most vestibular balance problems occur. And that's what controls, you know, the dizziness and all that stuff.
When you say homeopathic, what exactly do you mean by that?
It's all natural products. So what it consists of is it's powerful, it's all natural, there's proprietary ingredients. The main one's Cocculus indicus. That's known for its ability, you know, to alleviate dizziness as well as nausea. You know, after people use...
But what he was saying was Evan asked him, so what does homeopathic mean? And his response was, that means it's all natural. That was his response. And that was about as deep as he got on it. He didn't say anything about the laws of homeopathy, nothing about infinitesimal doses.
Speaking as a former hippie, current hippie, I used to take naturopathic remedies, and when I found homeopathic stuff, I asked people what it was, and they said, oh, it's all the same thing. It's all just nature. It's natural. And I thought, and it didn't work for me, and so I never tried it again just because of that, but I wasn't really, you know. Yeah. I wasn't a capital S skeptic yet. And it wasn't until I became a capital S skeptic that I learned what homeopathy actually is. And I think that there are millions of people who take homeopathy that don't understand it. And apparently there are people who peddle it who don't understand it.
Yeah, so yeah, whether it's deliberate or this guy's own ignorance, I suspect it's probably both. Yeah, it's actually being marketed as a natural remedy, not as what homeopathy really is.
Explain that, because I do ask him about what the numbers that are on the label.
All right, here we go.
That many customers do notice that they do have better balance, they have more energy, and, you know, they wake up with that unsteady feeling to start the day.
I'm sorry, I was just looking at the label that's on the website there. What are the ingredients? These ingredients are listed here under the drug facts for active ingredients, and there's numbers, like 21X, 55X. Like, are these, like, 55 times a normal dose? What do they mean by that?
It's just the, what that means is it's just the amount that's in it. It's really not, it doesn't mean like 55 times it out of the ingredients in it. That's the percentage of what, of more of that that's in it than the other stuff. Like, for instance, one that says 55X, what's the next one below that? Is there a lower number?
34X and then 21X.
Yeah, as opposed to, you know, the 34 one. If you compare the 34 one to the 55 one, there's more of the 55 one in it by about,
What the hell is he
doing? So there's more of the 55X than the 37X because 55 is a bigger number.
Yeah. Makes sense.
How much more? Oh, 55 over 37?
Oh. I probably don't have to explain it to this audience, but just in case you don't know, 55 times is the number of times that they shake the water into the to the active substance. So you do it one drop to 10, and then number 2 is 1 to 100, and 3, and then the number of zeros behind.
X is diluted 1 to 10. C is diluted 1 to 100. So 55X is diluted 1 to 10 55 times, which means there's nothing left, basically, at that point.
Yeah, so the higher the number, the
more
actual,
the more nothing it is.
Yeah, the more nothing it is.
Yeah, so he kind of blew that. They clearly really trained their salespeople well.
two of 100. Does that make sense? Like, there's just more ingredients of that one by about, like, 2/100 of the ingredient.
What you're saying is these numbers to the ingredient are comparative to each other is what, like, percentage of medicine?
Right.
Are there any, you know, studies or anything that support the evidence that Zyvestra really works for this?
Absolutely. Basically, how this came about, came around about 5 years ago. A pharmaceutical company came up with it, and what pharmaceutical companies do is, you know, they make the product, they do that, they run the test, and then they sell it to the highest bidder on who wants to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
We bought the rights to Zyvestra about 5 years ago. Since then, 78% of the people that use it continue to use it for over 9 months because it does give them the results. And this isn't just, you know, something you're going to have to use for years. This is actually something that does get to the root of the problem. You know, the more you take it, the more it's going to build up in your system. You're going to notice the dizziness happening less and less until eventually you're going to notice it not happening anymore.
Are there specific studies or any clinical studies that you can either point me to or that I might be able to find?
Are you on the website right now?
Yes, I am.
Do you see anything on there that says testimonials or anything like that or clinical studies?
Okay, Dr. Thomas Latino. Okay. Do you know if is this a independent study or is this a study that Zyvestra did?
This is an independent study.
Who is Dr. Thomas Latino associated with? Is he just the doctor who put together this particular page?
Yeah, it very well could be. I actually asked my managers who that guy was. They'd never heard of him.
Okay.
They never heard of this guy. Oh, yeah, I asked my bosses. They never heard of the guy. Right, so... Yeah, testimonials, in-house crappy studies by some guy they paid off. They don't even know who he is. I never heard of the guy. He's got no publication record. That's the evidence that it works. And it's all natural, and don't worry about those X numbers. Who knows what they really mean.
What we didn't bore you with is the other 15 minutes worth of sales pitch that went on with that phone call, which is what I frankly expected.
Yeah. Then he went into the hard sell, right, which was just sales copy, not anything specific to homeopathy.
But there it is.
I think this is our last news item. So this is an interesting blog that was pointed our direction by George Monbiotto. This is he is an environmentalist who was asking other environmentalists essentially about the evidence base for the risk of radiation exposure. So you know these are people who are on the anti-nuke side. You know, nuclear power is bad because radioactivity is very dangerous and the risks of nuclear power is very, very high, which, again, if that's your political opinion, that's fine. And that's his political opinion. Politically, that's where he is as well. But he said when he started asking his colleagues about the references to back up the point, because he wanted to know. He said, if I go out there and say it's really dangerous, what are the references that back up what I want to say that supports our position? And he started digging and realized that every reference led back to basically anecdote. It led back to a press release or a news article or somebody else's opinion piece that the evidence chain was not leading back to any actual published scientific research. And he found that this was very disturbing, right?
It is true. I mean, he did try to go back. He spoke to Dr. Helen Caldicott, who's one of the leading spokespeople, who's on behalf of those speaking out against nuclear energy and respect and warning of the dangers that would come from radiation. And he was asking her directly where he should go for this, following the citations that she was giving, and then coming back to her and pointing out that those citations didn't really lead anywhere. And nonetheless, she stood by a fundamental position that Chernobyl had harmed a gigantic number of people who couldn't really die.
Yeah, so the claim that's going around is that there were 985,000 additional deaths from Chernobyl, when the published evidence shows that the figure is probably closer to 6,000 or 7,000, most of which was from thyroid cancer because the Soviets or the Russians didn't provide the iodine that you would normally provide to an exposed population. Because, you know, the iodine will essentially block the take-up of radioactive iodine that would then concentrate in the thyroid gland and cause an increased risk of thyroid cancer. So most of the additional deaths were due to thyroid cancer because the precautions weren't taken. The most of the other deaths were in workers who were exposed. They were overexposed to radiation in Chernobyl, right in the power plant. Again, they were exposed to too high a dose. But the population at large, there really isn't any evidence that there was a lot of excess of deaths. But what the 985,000 figure came from was a study which counted every single additional, quote-unquote, additional death over the next 10 years or so in a very vast region around Chernobyl and assumed that it was caused by the radioactivity from Chernobyl. They didn't have any plausible reason to connect these extra deaths to the radioactivity exposure. So it's not a very good way to epidemiologically to come up with a number. And again, when he pressed on this, he was met with resistance, with, in fact, then claims that there's a conspiracy among scientists to hide the real data. And he said, yeah, this is all sounding a little familiar. You know, we hear this from the people that we criticize on the other end of the ideological spectrum. And, you know, this is very, again, very disturbing to him.
Yeah, I think what's interesting to me about looking at a lot of different pundits, people commenting in the public sphere after the Fukushima problems, is that it's actually amazing to see that he is about the closest thing I've seen to someone whose opinion on the issues of the dangers of nuclear energy has actually shifted one way or the other. I think, unfortunately,
for better or worse, this really does show the extent to which a lot of opinions, pro and con on this, are really entrenched in a way that has almost become kind of new fact resistance.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I one bright spot in here is that I thought it was interesting that he was learning from recent experience with other issues. So he has learned to recognize the pattern of insulating a belief from new evidence. And that's obviously a lesson that as skeptics we tried to promote. But I also think that the other thing that I thought of when I was reading that is like, yeah, but it also emphasizes for me that this is the job of the skeptical community is to remember these lessons and to constantly put them out there, because people do need to be constantly reminded of these patterns of behavior. It's really easy to get yourself wrapped into an ideological belief and then insulate yourself from evidence and to start to say, see conspiracies among scientists when they're bringing out data that disagrees with your position, and being dismissive of contradictory data and citing data of dubious origin when it supports your position. And this happened. This is almost the default sort of behavior that people get into, and it's really our job to document when this happens and to essentially have the memory of these events so that when it happens again, we can go, hey, remember the climate change debacle, remember, you know, evolution denial, remember HIV denial, remember all these other past things and the patterns of behavior that define these, and we can see these patterns to some or greater or lesser degree in new episodes that are happening, even sometimes on our own end of the political spectrum, which makes it all the much harder to see when it's, you know, your own beliefs that are falling into that pattern.
Right, and I think in his way, Lombia was writing about this. He's not, I think, even presenting this as somehow sort of a clincher argument that one should definitely be on sort of a pro-nuclear stance in this. I think, if anything, you can look at this and you can make what is, in effect, an anti-nuclear argument that says you have to be very careful that, you know, the experience of Chernobyl really shows you can't just focus on the technology and the science of this. A lot depends on the surrounding of the social context
right.
and how the institutions will succeed or fail surrounding an accident like
right.
this.
Right.
But in any case, intellectual integrity, we do need to try to strip away exactly these kinds of problems.
But I give him a lot of credit. I mean, here he's people on his own end of the ideological spectrum, and he, you know, was savvy enough to say, hey, this is not right. We have to police ourselves, which I think is, again, the other lesson to derive from this. If you don't police yourself and your own group, other people will do it for you, and that puts you kind of in an awkward position when, you know, you're being made to defend what turns out to be a pseudoscientific position. It also weakens your ideological position, because if you make your ideological position dependent on bad science that then gets debunked, now, again, you're in a very awkward position.
Yeah, I mean, and this obviously could be a much longer, more complicated argument because this is it's almost a perfect example of the sort of thing of where your goals in trying to maintain a kind of intellectual integrity and being upfront about all of these things can genuinely be at odds with a certain amount of the communication, certain messages, and being, say, politically effective, which may favor a much more simplified, stripped-down approach.
Yeah, I think we noticed that even in the skeptical community. You know, I've talked about this before, about how I find it difficult sometimes when we're combating people who are angry about big pharma. You know, and it's difficult for me to just tell them, well, that doesn't exist, and pharmaceutical companies have your best interests in mind.
Yeah.
You know, that would be nice if I could say that. But unfortunately, as Ben Goldacre says, you know, I think you'll find it's a bit more complicated than that.
Right.
And making a nuanced argument that accepts the fact that large industries can cause harm while also establishing that the scientific method still works and this is why is really difficult. And
it's a hard sell.
Yeah.
But that's why we have to focus on process and not the answer. Because oftentimes the answer is, it's complicated. You know, and it's hard, that's hard to put on a bumper sticker. I guess you could put that on a bumper
sticker. Actually, it's just two words.
Yeah, that's true. Now I think that's a good bumper sticker. But but in terms of like a specific topic, like Phil touched on the idea, do vaccines cause autism? It's nice to say, no, next. But, you know, in reality, there's a lot of nuances to the issue, and then depending on the sophistication of the person asking the question, you have to delve into those nuances, and then it starts to water down the impact of your position. But, you know, that's why you have to emphasize, but it's really the method and the logic that we have to focus on here, because the evidence and the conclusions are always going to be messy. Yeah. All right, let's move on. I want to make sure we have some time at the end for some Q&A. Very quickly, we promised that we were going to give the best of our listener-submitted You Know You're a Skeptic If. We went over a few of these in response to a question we had a few weeks ago, and we did get a lot of emails, and we have a few up here, so I'll just read them out. You know you're a skeptic if, on your wall calendar, Mr. or Mrs. July has more than three PhDs. You think magician is a gateway hobby. Skip that one. You find yourself... you gotta be quick. You find yourself understanding more than half of Bob's section of the HDU.
Guess I'm not scared. Yeah.
The abbreviation SGU does not mean the canceled television show Stargate Universe, although you probably also know what that means, too.
Man, I was so glad when that got canceled.
Yeah.
That
was
it might
awesome.
Have been a great show, but leave our acronym alone.
Yeah, we had it first.
Yeah.
Okay, the word nano makes you giddy. You just can't bring yourself to find Jenny McCarthy attractive anymore and feel guilty when Jim Carrey makes you laugh.
We might have a minute there.
You remember what the U in UFO stands for. I believe that was the last one.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
All right, we're going to do, as we always do, we're going to do a quick science or fiction, and then hopefully have some time for some Q&A at the end. Now, during the live shows, the way we do this is I will read the three items. Again, two are real, one is fake. I will then poll the audience by applause so that we can actually hear it, not hands or anything, and to see which one you guys think is the fake. Then we will get some advice from our expert panel of skeptics, and we'll see what kind of influence they had on your decisions, and then I'll do the reveal. So here they are, a little bit wordy this week. I apologize. There is a theme this week. The theme is all astronomy. This is for no other reason than to pay homage to my good friend Phil Plait, who is our keynote speaker, and thanks for coming to the event, Phil. It also was the three items I found, but you know, it sounds better to say it to Phil. All right, here we go. Item number one. Wait till the end for your applause. Item number one. Astronomers have discovered a binary pair of white dwarf dead stars that will one day merge into a new active star. Item number two. Scientists find that deep space travel is likely to cause vascular disease in astronauts. And item number three. Astronomers have recently discovered a near-Earth asteroid in a rare horseshoe orbit. It reverses its course around the sun, traveling in a sea or horseshoe path due to Earth's gravity. Okay, so let's give you a moment to digest those. So how many people in the audience, again, indicate with your applause, how many people think that item number one is the fiction, is not true? Okay. How many people think that item number two about deep space travel causing vascular disease is not true? Okay, that one's a little more believable. And how many think that item number three about the asteroid in a horseshoe orbit is not true? Okay. All right, Bob, you want to help him out?
I wish I had a hard copy to look at.
I'll go.
All right, Bob. Jay will go while Bob reads. Go ahead.
Okay, so astronomers have discovered... I always do this. Sorry, Travis. Has discovered a binary pair of white dwarf dead stars that will one day merge into a new active star. So when a star turns into a white dwarf, I don't know if it actually is too small at that point, even if you doubled its mass, that it could actually turn back into, you know, a normal star, that, you know, with the pressures changing, you know, all that stuff, the gravitational pressure that has to be balanced. I don't know. I'm not too sure about that, but I obviously could be wrong. The second one, scientists find deep space travel is likely to cause vascular disease. So, yeah, I think this one is the fake because I know that your blood pressure changes when you stand up, when you sit down, when you lie down, and I know that you have valves in your legs that, as your heart pumps, you know, the blood really can't go backwards. Sorry, guys, I'm trying to look over here. So, the blood really can't go backwards as your heart pumps. And I would imagine that if you're floating in outer space for an extended period of time, and I'm assuming they're saying that space travel, yeah, that you're not on a ship that has fake gravity, that, yeah, I would say that one's the fake. Wait. No, I agree with that one. Duh, sorry. I can't. Yeah, three's fake.
All right, John, why don't you go next?
Okay, well, let's see. I think as far as the one about the astronauts and the vascular disease, that I can believe that's kind of real, because when you are in space, you get a lot of edema fluids floating all around. I don't know if that vascular disease that they might be talking about is something that recurs once they're back here on terra firma, and, you know, maybe it's sort of messed up people's circulatory systems in the process, but I can believe that's a problem. The last one about the horseshoe-shaped orbit has a kind of, you know, Mercury in retrograde thing to it that immediately gives me the creeps. But I'm willing to give that there's some sort of bizarre celestial mechanics benefit of the doubt on that. I think I'm going along with Jay's reasoning on the first one. I think that even if you take two white dwarfs, they're kind of dead. They don't have a lot of hydrogen left. If you smash them together, I don't think you get a brand new big normal star anymore.
So you think that one's the fiction?
I think that's the fiction.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Bob?
Okay. The merged stars, yeah, I mean, a white dwarf, I mean, isn't that what the sun's going to turn into? I mean, there's not enough mass there. There's tiny, I think it's going to be as big as the Earth, I think. It's, yeah, there's just not enough there, I think. I should have hit that one last, shouldn't I? Let me go to the second one. Vascular disease. There's so many problems when you're weightless. Calcium leaching from your bones. So many problems. I could really see that vascular disease could be one of them. Although I don't know the specifics about vascular disease to really make an informed guess here. The third one, orbital mechanics can be real tricky and counterintuitive. I can kind of see some sort of funky orbit happening with a near Earth asteroid like that. So I'm buying that one as well. So the first one, I think, the merged white dwarfs, I think that one is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, it's pretty much all been said already, but I'm reminded of there was a study where they were locking people in a small capsule as a sort of test to see this is what happens if we're going to send someone out for like a year or something. They were well paid, but my God, what an awful, awful experiment to go through.
Biodome.
So I don't know, maybe that's ended recently and that's where that one came from. I could certainly understand that. Number two, I mean. And the idea of the asteroid, that makes sense to me. So I'm gonna agree with the guys and say that the first one is the fiction.
The white dwarfs.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, Evan?
I'll take them in reverse order. The horseshoe path due to Earth's gravity. I think that one's feasible. Pretty much for the same reasons that Bob stated. There's some unique things that are traveling out there. And this one, I don't see why that would be any different. As far as vascular disease goes and astronauts, sure. There's so many things we do know about space travel that has an effect on the human body that's a lot of it not good, and certainly this one would fit right into that category as well. Therefore, that leaves the first one about these dead dwarf stars merging into a new active star. Now, they may merge, but into something. I don't know if it's going to be an active star, though, so I think that one's fiction.
All right, so on the panel, at least, Jay is all by himself thinking that the horseshoe orbit is fiction. Everyone else think that the white dwarfs merging is fiction. Let's see what influence they had on the audience. How many people in the audience think that the white dwarfs merging is fiction? Okay, the deep space travel causing vascular disease? And the asteroid in the horseshoe orbit? Okay. That was a lot more even between 1 and 3, I think, after the panel sounded off. But it seems like everyone in the room, except for that one guy over there, thinks that deep space travel is likely to cause vascular disease in astronauts. And that one is, I'd love for that one to be the fiction, but it's science. But nobody hit upon the actual mechanism. This was a study in animals, and it was already known that low levels of radioactivity, of radiation exposure, can cause atherosclerosis. It can accelerate atherosclerosis and cause vascular disease, heart disease. And so what they did was they exposed rats to the kind of radiation that you would get within deep space, which is different than the kind of radiation we get on the Earth.
Oh, so it's not weightlessness at all.
It's not weightlessness.
It's the radiation.
It's the cosmic radiation.
Yeah.
So we already know about the long exposure to cosmic radiation being a bad thing and being almost a deal killer for deep space travel until we figure out some way to shield anything living inside, yeah, surrounding the outer
magnetic
hull
field.
Yeah,
didn't they take into effect the homeopathic influence of that radiation, though?
No, so they were too limited in their hypotheses, apparently. So that one is absolutely science.
All right, wait. If the audience and I win, if we get it right, what do we get?
My respect.
Okay.
I know you're still working on that one.
Yeah, thumbs up.
All right, let's go to number one. Astronomers have discovered a binary pair of white dwarf dead stars that will one day merge into a new active star. Everyone but Jay thinks that one is the fiction. About half the audience think that one is the fiction. And that one is science.
Wow. Respect.
Good work, Jay.
Nice job.
Everyone that,
nice
job, that agreed with me, just stand up now. Let's do it. Fred, you represent all. Thank you. The audience and I are
good
tight,
job,
man. All right. So, yeah, this is really interesting. And you guys hit upon the one thing that's very curious about this. So, yeah, astronomers have previously identified two white dwarf stars in a very close orbit. But this, only a few though, really only a few. This is one of the very few that they've discovered, and they're in the closest orbit that they've ever identified before. And they estimate that in about a million years or so, they're actually going to merge together into one object. Now, these are two stars that have exhausted most of their fuel, obviously not all of their fuel, and that's why they have collapsed down to a white dwarf. Now, stars that are only big enough to collapse down to white dwarfs as opposed to neutron stars or black holes actually don't have the gravity and the mass to burn through all of their fuel. They work through their hydrogen, and then they start burning helium, and then they start burning down and down until you get to iron. And then iron, you can't get energy out of it whether you fuse it or fizz it. So if you're a big enough star to get down to an iron core, then you're totally, totally done. But you have to be a big star. Only bigger and bigger stars burn more and more of their fuel. So stars of a certain size will burn their hydrogen. When you get a bigger size, it'll burn through. Then it'll have enough gravity to burn helium. But only bigger stars still will burn whatever's next, you know, lithium and then oxygen, whatever, and working your way up to iron. So if you have two stars that are white dwarfs, when they merge, they become big enough to start burning fuel that they weren't previously big enough to burn. And then, of course, that ignition will puff them out into a normal star again.
So the increase in gravity actually gives it...
It's the increased mass will actually enable them to burn fuel they were not previously able to burn.
Yeah, but it had, before it reached the red giant stage, it had plenty of mass. Why didn't it just burn it up then?
No, it didn't. It never had enough mass to get the higher pressures needed to fuse the heavier elements.
Yeah, but when a red giant sheds its outer atmosphere, it's losing a lot of mass. I would think that extra white dwarf would kind of just adding back what it already lost, but obviously it's a little bit more. So okay,
obviously it's enough that they think that it will actually ignite into a new star. But
so Bob, what happens is white dwarfs, they combine. You see. And even though that they might have a lead or even a steel core.
Blah, blah. Yeah, cool, Jay.
Right. But you'll try next week. Don't worry about it, man.
Great talking smack. You won once in the last, like...
Hey, when did you get a chance?
You know, haven't you been humiliated enough?
This happens to be our 300th episode, too, which is pretty damn cool.
Irrelevant.
Right, which means astronomers have recently discovered a near-Earth asteroid in a rare horseshoe orbit. It reverses its course around the sun, traveling in a sea or horseshoe path due to Earth's gravity is fiction.
But, Steve, this morning, you know, I was out at the bar all night, and I definitely was going through my feed reader, and there was something about an asteroid. And
you fell into my trap.
Yeah, I knew you would know that I would be very tired this morning.
It's a retrograde motion, right? It doesn't
There is an asteroid, and a recently discovered near-Earth asteroid in a horseshoe orbit, because the orbit is only in that shape when viewed from the Earth. That is the apparent motion of the asteroid. It will seem to go into, as you said, the retrograde, but it's actually to itself, it's going all the way around the sun. It's never reversing the direction of its orbit. But what the asteroid is doing, and the reason why it appears to reverse its path in the sky, is because it's a little... Sometimes the asteroid is a little bit closer to the sun than the Earth, and therefore it's traveling faster than the Earth. And when it catches up to the Earth, the gravity of the Earth switches it so that it's a little bit farther away than the Earth from the sun. So then it slows down again until the Earth catches up with it, and then it flips back again so that it's closer to the sun. Right? So that's what's really interesting. It's flipping back and forth from being just a little bit closer to being just a little bit farther. And therefore, when it's a little bit closer, it's moving in one direction. And then when it gets a little bit farther away, it moves in the other direction in terms of its apparent motion from the Earth. We've identified that there are large chunks of ice and rock, in, for example, in Saturn's rings, which do this. They sort of swap places as they pass by each other. So I think this is a very rare occurrence in terms of a near-Earth asteroid. Most of these orbits are very unstable, so they don't survive for a long time, but the astronomers say this one is in an unusually stable orbit that can survive, I think they said, for millions of years, but, you know, not forever. I mean, it's still, that's why they're rare. All right, we have a few minutes left. We take a few questions, so we're going to do a Q&A.
Just as sort of a fun thought experiment, given all of your practical and theoretical knowledge about science in all different fields, if the rogues were teleported back in time like 1,000 years, what type of actual scientific advances do you guys think together you would be capable of achieving, either in just teaching people about the world or actually making yourself and teaching other people?
Assuming we wanted to interfere with the timeline.
Well, you'd have to.
Otherwise, we could create all kinds of paradoxes.
Yeah, and also, we wouldn't even be on Earth anymore because the Earth would have moved 1,000 years.
Yes. So we'd have to move in time and space.
Gasping in
space. You've got to suspend your disbelief because teleporting is impossible anyway. Just go with it.
All right. Assuming that's true, believe it or not, I've actually thought about that. At
length. Haven't we talked about it before?
In the past?
I think we talked about how...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Am I done now? I think we talked about how none of us would actually be able to make so much as a toaster if we...
Well, yeah. But what could we do? I think probably the biggest impact in terms of what we could impart to people of that time is the scientific method itself. Yeah. To really lay out the process of observation, of doing controlled studies, of statistics and repetition, and that itself, accelerate the process of turning what at the time they had just the beginnings of natural philosophy. It wasn't really even science yet. And it's sort of accelerating the process of just philosophically and methodologically developing science itself. I think that would be probably the biggest thing we could do.
Imagine the fields you could just bootstrap by. You take some pond water and get some polished glass if you can and just say, look at these organisms in the water.
Right.
And then just sit back and watch these sciences flower just from this one thing that you could show people.
Or we'd be burned at the stake.
Yeah, that's more likely.
That's more likely, actually.
Next.
Okay, so I heard about this a couple weeks ago, but I was saving it up because I knew that I was coming to Nexus, and I wanted to ask you guys about it.
Okay.
But I heard this on another podcast, which I'm going to withhold the name of for now until I hear what you have to say about it. But there's apparently several doctors around the world, one of whom is in Australia, who are curing or supposedly curing chronic ailments by means of fecal transplantation.
Oh boy.
Have you guys heard of this? And what is your opinion of it?
Steve?
This relates to this area of, and I don't know about the state of actually treating ailments or curing them yet, but this is, there's a lot of interest these days in what people talk about of the microbiome, which is the complex and largely uncharted ecosystem of little microorganisms that live on us and inside us. And there's a very great assumption that these may be very involved with our health, particularly in some sorts of things like gut inflammatory diseases and the rest. And with those, you can perhaps in some cases fix people's damaged intestinal flora by giving them a tiny, tiny little dose of somebody else's poop.
Right. And
this is going to be a really fascinating area. It's very easy to overstate what may be the long-term influence of a lot of this. The variation and fluctuation in our own, these kind of microbiota is huge, much greater than our own fluctuation in health. So I think it's going to be really important, but it's hard to know whether or not it really makes a difference.
But there's a familial connection, isn't there?
Yeah, family members share their flora. Right, Jay and Bob?
Yeah.
Steve says that because all of our farts smell exactly alike. So.
Actually, Wednesday.
Sadly.
More things that are usually edited out of the final show.
Yeah. What's ironic is that we actually had a long conversation about the fecal transplant several weeks ago on the show, and we didn't have time to include it. And the running joke is, like, every week, it's like, all right, this week I'm going to include the fecal transplant bit that we recorded, and we just never have time for it. It even inadvertently made its way into the show notes a couple weeks ago. Because I forgot that I didn't have time to include it in. So we actually already did this conversation. But very quickly, everything that John said is correct. However, the particular physician in Australia who is promoting this notion is going well beyond just fixing problems with the gut biota and gastrointestinal problems to saying that he can cure multiple sclerosis and other kinds of autoimmune diseases. And there is no evidence for that. Okay. I think he's going massively beyond both the theoretical and empirical basis for this. So it remains to be seen how useful this will be. But I think that those current claims are getting way well beyond the evidence. But interestingly, in addition to just transplanting bacteria, there's already teams who are also looking at genetically engineering gut bacteria to do all kinds of interesting things. And that may really be where we can start to alter and affect health by putting genetically engineered microbes into the gut. Sure. We have time for one more question.
Hello. Do you think that skeptics who are learned or experts regarding a certain idea or belief that poses a danger to society have some sort of ethical responsibility to go public and educate if their environment is a safe one?
Sure. So if there is a harmful belief out in this society, and we know it's harmful because of our exposure, our background, our education, should we oppose it? Don't we do that? I mean, isn't that an obvious yes?
Well, a lot of skeptics remain silent on the issues.
Well, yeah, I think what he's saying is we do that, but not necessarily everyone in our audience is constantly rebutting random beliefs that people bring up to them in everyday life. And I think, you know, there are extenuating circumstances when, you know, you don't necessarily have the tools you need to combat these beliefs, or you might not even have all of the facts necessary or the platform or whatever. But if you do have the facts and if you do have the platform, then I would say that there's a certain...
Sure. I mean, I think I would mitigate that a little by saying that there's probably 1,000 things you could say that people have a moral obligation to oppose that's happening in our society or in our world. And how much energy and time can we expend going after every single thing we think of as a problem in our society? You do have to kind of pick your battles and go with your strength and your interest and things
and
that
you're passionate
about.
I mean, that's if you're passionate about it, spend the time.
I do agree with picking something. It doesn't have to be everything. You don't have to fight every battle out there, but picking something that you're interested in, you're good at, you're passionate about, and then contribute to society that way. You know, you don't necessarily have to take up every single banner that's out there because you don't have time to live.
Thank you.
All right. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. But so thank you all for showing up to our 300th episode.
Thank you.
And to
next week.
Before Jay's quote, before Jay gives his closing quote, I just wanted to thank all of the organizers of Nexus, especially Michael Feldman, who really does a lot of the heavy lifting for this conference. This conference is really made by him. Thank you, Michael. Thanks, Todd, for being a wonderful host. And Jay's going to quickly give our closing quote.
It's a quick quote. I love it. I think everyone can relate to it. The quote is, "You can't trust everything that you read on the internet." It's a quote by Abraham Lincoln.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice. Theorem is performed by Kineto and used with permission.